Human beings and human doers, happy holiday season. This is Paulo Espanola, and you are listening to episode 32 of Hidden Apron Radio, where we explore the many stories hidden in plain sight amongst our food. We believe food can be used to solve most of the world's problems, and this show looks at the many ways food can be used to connect us to ourselves and each other, even if we don't look alike or speak the same language. We've talked to chefs, farmers, technologists, artists, and everyone in between, and today is the third installment of our new Filipino Kitchen series. In case you missed our last two episodes, one with chefs Robert Menor Rodelio, the Food Buddha Aglibot, and Joanne Boston in the West Coast, or the Villa Vincencio sisters Katrina and Christina and food truck owner Alexa Alfaro on the East/Midwest Coast edition, we're sitting down with the various co-authors of the new Filipino Kitchen cookbook that I was honored to be a part of and was published by Agate Suri this past September. Just as the recipes in the book, the people writing them are of such diverse backgrounds, challenging the idea that Filipino food is just one thing and that there is only one way into this food industry. Today on the show, filmed shortly after the previous one, we have returning guest Alexa Alfaro, who we learned during the last episode dropped out of her engineering degree weeks before graduation to open Milwaukee's only Filipino food truck, Meat on the Street, with her family. Joining her is Delena Beneventi, who both works in tech as well as being a self-published author with her memoir, Asian Girl in Southern World, which recounts her experiences of being born in Tennessee, the first Filipina born in that hospital ever, reaching international acclaim. Food is central to the book and to Delena's identity, and she's even had the opportunity to work with Paula Deen, which sounds very stereotypically Southern, but Delena does a really good job of melding both her Southern and Filipino identities, both in this book and the new Filipino kitchen. You could say this is the half-seas episode, as all three of us are of mixed heritage, me being Chinese-Filipino, and Alexa and Delena being half-Caucasian. We talk about the realities and challenges of straddling racial and cultural lines, and what it's like to go back home to the Philippines, and however you define home. We also dig into the ways we balance being relatable without diluting who we are, especially when we're trying to connect with communities where we don't exactly fit 100% in. You could say this episode is also about balance, balancing the expansion of your business while still serving your home team, your day ones, so to speak. How to balance affordability and access, especially when you're in the restaurant industry or food truck business, with charging what you think you're actually worth. So, titas who think Filipino food, or any food for that matter, should be cheap, this episode's for you. Staying sane, be it in the food truck business or trying to balance a day job like Delena with the side hustle. So all in all, I think there's a lot of nuance in these conversations that often gets overlooked in favor of simpler narratives. And being the half-sea episode, we really look at those contradictions and those difficulties when you're trying to go in that middle border that straddles your identities. So if you're half-sea or find yourself straddling multiple worlds, jobs, identities, give this episode a listen. And without further ado, Alexa and Delena. Delena and Alexa, well, Alexa, welcome back.
Hi.
To the show. Welcome to Delena for being on the show for the first time.
Thank you.
I wanted to start actually with you, Delena, because mm-hmm. for the last few episodes that I've been doing this with regarding the book, I've been asking the same question of, one, how did Jackie find you?
Yeah.
And what was your reaction to her contacting you? Like, how did you then like fall into this project, right? Because there was a lot of people who were in this project. I wanted to hear your side.
Yeah. So I was actually touring. I believe I was already touring for my first book, Asian Girl in a Southern World. And I don't know how it all works. I think I was Googling it to see if it was coming up yet in search results, how much of the title I needed to type into Google for it to auto-populate.
Nice. That was smart.
Because I had worked really hard on just on a marketing plan and a strategy, and I knew it had, some people had bought it. And so I was wondering if it was being recognized and however that works in the search engines. And when I was doing that, I saw something come up about the migrant Filipino and then the Facebook page. And I thought, oh, there's another Filipino book out there or one that's being created or something like that. Because I've not been plugged into the world of Filipino literature. So I didn't know what was out there. So anything that has to do with that, it just piques my interest. And then somehow we started talking on Facebook and she said, hey, I've got this project and I would love for you to be a part of it. You know, I think you have a really interesting story. Would you be willing to be a contributor? And I said, anything you want, I want to be a part of it.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't remember exactly how those conversations took place, but it was over Facebook originally. And that's how we found each other.
This has been a recurring theme that without the power of social and technology, this probably would have been a very hard project or nearly impossible.
Yeah.
As much as the negative effects of...
But how would you connect all of us? How would they... How would I have been found? How would you have
Friendster,
been found?
Friendster, man, you know?
I remember Friendster.
I'm like, I don't know what Friendster even is.
What?
Yeah.
Did you skip Friendster?
I must have.
No. I was on Friendster.
See, I was on Friendster.
I
don't even know what Friendster is.
It was like the pre-Facebook...
I did MySpace.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. It was around those days.
Both are like not quite it.
No, because MySpace was huge, but
it was huge. It was MySpace, more music driven.
Yes.
Though.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I want to ask this one because as we were talking about planning for this episode, it was like, well, we're all halfsies, right?
Yeah.
When you were going into the project, or even when you were doing your own work, right? Whether it was with Meet on the Street or whether it was your own book, did you actively say I am Filipino, or like how did you identify yourself
with my book or
with any of your work? Like do you actively say like, oh, I'm Filipino, or how did you identify yourself to like the outside world? I guess,
you know, I think even today, even you asked me that and I had to qualify the question.
Yeah.
I think sometimes I still struggle with how to identify myself because I grew up in a situation where there wasn't a category for me, you know, like my mom, my sister and I, we were practically the only Filipinos in the area. And so it wasn't like there was a lot of us where I could say, this is my group. Eventually I started just telling people I'm half Filipino, half Caucasian. And when I was writing, that's where the story went with my book. And then it just trickled over into the story through in the new Filipino kitchen too. But I don't think I'm always very conscious of it. I think it's just because it's so much a part of me that it just kind of comes out when I'm writing.
Yeah.
That, you know, because the story I keep telling is that I'm out there. I was out there in this place where nobody knew about us and our culture and what that was like for, you know, my mom to find ingredients to cook the proper meals and for me and my sister to not hear the other side of the language because my mom had the phone up to her ear so we couldn't hear the people responding
to
her.
Was it Tagalog?
Yes, yes, yes. But, you know, it was hard for us to learn and I still don't speak it because I couldn't hear the other part of the conversation. So it's just a one-sided, you know, and you need those facial expressions and you need to hear how other people respond in order to really get the language. Otherwise, you're just hearing sounds.
Oh, you should have been in the... So after you left last night, Christina, Katrina, and I were talking about speaking the language because they could completely understand it. They could pretty much speak it too.
Mm-hmm.
But we got to the point where in some cases, my dialect, for example, it doesn't even matter if you know the words fluently. It's the intonation and the flow and the rhythm and the facial expressions that you like... You need to pick that up before you could be considered.
Mm-hmm.
How about for you, Alexa?
For me, growing up, I was always obviously not Caucasian in everyone's mind. Just because I have dark hair, I have dark skin. Mm-hmm. So for that reason, I had to identify Filipino.
Yeah.
But I tried to tell, one time I would write on applications, I started writing like half Caucasian. Or I would mark the Caucasian box because I am 50%. I am equally Filipino. And people would be like, well, you're not Caucasian, you're something else. So my Filipino side has always dominated purely in physical like attributes that I have. So I always had to claim it. You know, if I'm talking to 100% Filipino, the fact that I don't speak it and the fact that I'm half obviously like dilutes my how Filipino are you level, which I don't agree with, but that's just how it goes. Yeah. We all experience the same thing in that way. But clearly I'm not clearly I'm more than Caucasian, so I've always had to identify it for that reason.
Did either side ever dominate in terms of making you feel like, oh, I belong on this side?
You know what I mean? I grew up suburban Caucasian schools,
yeah,
area environment. So like environmental, I feel like who I am and what I identify with, like, yeah, I'm a white girl from the suburbs, but as far as like when you look at me, when you talk to me, if you refer to me, I am Filipino, and people know that's how they refer to me, like, oh yeah, gotcha, she's Filipino. So it's a very big mix of both. And I mean, mm-hmm, my dad's very Filipino when you meet him. Like I said, we were talking last night, and like it was really casual for like there to be like a fish head the size of a football chilling in my fridge. Yeah. Like that's a norm for my Filipino side, but like my white friends would be like, what do you do with that exactly? Like all freaked out. Like, yes, you cook that? You don't just throw that away? Like, so I think in my life it's constantly been like the back and the forth of it.
Should be like, we burn it in our lawn and dance around it, just summon the river spirits.
We make voodoo dolls out of it and poke them.
We pray for a better harvest next year. And the reason I ask that is, I mentioned it too in the first launch, right? It's almost like you're both sides, you belong, mm-hmm, to them, but instead of you could equally belong in either, both sides also say like, you're not quite
here, this or that, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah.
So for you, yeah, now I'm sure, I was reading your story, it's probably a lot more jarring, but yeah, when you did go to the Philippines, mm-hmm, because I think the Tennessee side, we can imagine what that's like growing up in a predominantly white place that's never, like, I think someone asked you if it's part of Japan, right?
Yeah,
but
they
did. When you went to Philippines, how was the reception there? Did they see you as like, oh, you're one of us, you just don't speak the language, or it's like, oh, you're something else?
I love this question. I was so looking forward to going to the Philippines because I thought, I'm finally going to fit in. I'm gonna know what it feels like, mm-hmm, to just be one of everybody else.
Yeah.
Because my whole life, I wasn't. I always stuck out. And then we got off of the plane, and I still don't understand why. And my mom is tired of trying to explain it to me.
Yeah.
But people thought I was famous for some reason. And I got off the plane, and like my mom had to like start pushing people, and my aunts had to start pushing people. I still don't understand it. There's too much of a cultural gap for me to understand why I was received that way. So when I got off the plane, it was completely shocking because I thought, finally, I'm going to be able to just walk off this plane. I'm not going to get any looks. As long as I don't talk, nobody's going to know I have, yeah, this Southern accent. Yeah. I'm going to look like I speak Tagalog. Yeah. Like everybody's just going to think I'm another person, and I'm going to know what that feels like. And as soon as I got off the plane, like people were trying to like grab my jewelry, and it was like pretty intense. It was intense. Yeah. It was really, really, mm-hmm, intense.
When okay, so place us in the time, right? When was this?
Yeah, okay, so I graduated in 1995, so it was, okay, 1995.
And it was in Manila or somewhere else?
It was Manila. And my mom had told me that I knew a lot of people in the Philippines. My mom was raised there until she was a teenager. And she would always come back from the Philippines saying, oh, the person that stamped my passport, I went to high school with him. Or, you know, it was like, she always knew these people.
What's your cousin?
And right, everybody's your cousin.
What is it, really, your cousin?
What related? It doesn't matter.
Are we just saying that until you get in an argument with his mom and then he's not my cousin anymore? Right?
Yeah, yeah.
We're all related until they get into a fight. They're, yeah, like, you're not related to them anymore. Yeah. It was 1995 and I was 18. I was with my mom, my aunt, and my grandmother, and it was, I was just so looking forward to it. And then I don't think they really knew what to expect either, but that's, did I answer your question?
Yeah, yeah, mm-hmm, yeah. So that, okay, was, so that was off the plane, but when, yeah, you met your family, how, yep, did that go?
My mom had, and my aunt and my grandmother had taught me how to bless.
Okay.
So as soon as I met them, I knew what to do.
Okay.
And they saw me as very respectful, even though I didn't speak the language. But then I was really stressed out about the food part because, like I had explained, I wasn't feeling well because of the culture shock and just, I wasn't used to the hot weather, yeah, and everything about it was, but you know, if we don't eat the food, they get their feelings hurt,
yeah,
you know? And so I was feeling bad about feeling sick, and then I was like trying to force myself to eat, and because you know, I was in these moments where I realized like this is my elder, these people paved the way for me in some shape or form, whether they realized it or whether I realized it or not. I owe them respect and gratitude. And maybe the only way we can speak to each other is through this meal.
Yeah.
So I don't want to offend or ruin this very rare, precious moment by creating some kind of an obstruction through the one conversation we could have, which could be this bowl of rice, you know?
Like, yeah.
That's all we have right now. So there was a lot of pressure I felt for myself. Not that necessarily they were putting it on me, but I wanted to do well. I wanted my mom to be proud of bringing her daughter. And I wanted to really, I wanted my mom to be proud. I wanted people to pat her on the back and say, oh, you have a good daughter. She's great. Yeah. You know, all
expectation,
these.
Expectation,
man. Yeah.
Expectation.
Expectation. I wanted it. Mm-hmm. You know, I wanted it for her.
Yeah.
And for my aunt and for my grandmother, too, you know.
And so how did that trip then end?
Beautifully. I remember my mom saying, everything you pack, expect to leave. You're not going to come home with any of it.
Yeah.
And so I remember I packed all clothes that I wanted to give as gifts.
Yeah.
And
Levi's.
So,
we packed the dark Levi's.
Yep.
And yeah, and any kind of shirts that I thought were pretty or cute with flowers or ruffles. I ended up being a godparent while I was there.
Oh.
And I
wow.
Know, just and I didn't know them. I didn't know them. But mom was like, well, they asked you, so you can't
you
say no.
You have to say yes, yeah.
You can't say
most
no.
Most people are like, oh, what you do on vacation? You know, I went to this resort.
I know.
I became a godparent.
I became a godparent. So I went home with I think I had a purse with my passport, like some cash. I think I even left my suitcase behind. And I came back with my aunt because my mom and my grandma wanted to stay. My Lola stayed a little bit longer. So I came back and I really felt like I had experienced what I was supposed to experience.
Okay.
Yeah.
Was your experience the same, Alexa? Because we didn't talk about this last night.
So when you took your trip. I went to the Philippines when I was in fifth grade. I went with my dad's extended family, and I went for 8 turned into 12 weeks. Yeah.
You lived there.
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. And we lived in, like, we didn't live in a resort. We lived in, like,
yeah,
just not what I'm used to from America. So we couldn't, I couldn't drink the water. Drank Coca-Cola the whole time.
Yeah.
When we had breakfast.
You're in the city?
Yeah, kind of.
Yeah.
I don't want to refer to it in this word, but like, just not, yes.
It's not the subdivision, that's for sure.
Yes, definitely not a subdivision. Oh, I got checked for lice every night. There are people living in boxes or tires down the road. I mean, we lived in a house, it was a very nice house. There's no water pressure, so I showered with a bucket and a pail, and it was cold water.
Yeah.
It's 115 freaking degrees every day. So, but I loved it, and I was in fifth grade, so I could handle it. Didn't bother me on any level whatsoever. I mean, there was ants crawling in the sugar, and they'd be like, do you want some? I'm like, I'm good. Thank you for offering. Like, and, you know, there are cockroaches that are, like, the size of a freaking cell phone nowadays. They're flying around. They're
That's
everywhere.
The part that gets you, that they fly.
Oh, my God.
Because I'm like, you know, I could stand the size. I'm like, you know what? You're across the room. That's fine. And then they fly. And then you're like, nah, fuck it. I'm going home.
Whenever people are like, cockroaches, I'm like, that is not a cockroach. That's a fake cockroach. Like, if you want a real cockroach, you go to the Philippines. And, like, they would, so you clean the kitchen, you do all the dishes from family meal or whatever, and then you turn on the lights the next morning, they cover everything. Like in that movie, what is it called? Where they defeat the bugs and they go everywhere.
Bugs?
Oh, what is it called?
Is it older?
It's old, yeah.
Arachno. No.
I can't remember it. It'll come to me.
I feel like I
It's like, it's not Starship Troopers,
no,
right?
No. Okay. Will Smith is in it. It's one of his earlier movies with the white guy.
I know what you're talking about.
Men in Black.
Yes.
Men in Black.
So it's like that, where all of a sudden it's covered and I'm sitting here.
And they look at you.
Yeah.
Oh. They have personality.
No, for real. They look at you and they're like, we know you're going to the mall right now, but when you come back, we're going to be waiting.
Yeah, they don't F around and they cover everything. You had to rewash all the dishes. I'm like, why do we even wash them? Like, what is the point? Yeah. So, like, it was just very different environmentally. It was awesome, though. When I went there, they looked at me and they all told me I was big. I was in fifth grade on top of it. As a female, I don't want to hear that. Yeah. Like, I'm in fifth grade and they're like, you're so big for your age. And they don't mean big as in, like, my weight is off. They mean it as in I'm very tall. I'm very, like, I'm not, you know, short, petite Filipino. They mean it as, like, you're tall. You have, you know, like, a little bit of extra meat on you type of a thing. So that's, and that's what they meant by it. But that was it. They all just told me, you're so tall. But I was raised to be very respectful. You know, we had, it was fun. It was cool. It was an experience. Yeah. But they were nice. Overall, they were very nice to me.
Here's the part that I always like, whenever I hear people talk about their experiences in the Philippines, always gets me is the fine line. And oftentimes we're like really subconscious or unconscious about this, that we tread between being relatable enough, but somehow still being true to our like own identity, right? Yeah. Because this then extends into like, okay, how do you talk about your own work then, right? How have you navigated that where, whether it's with family or whether it's with like the book or with the food truck too, of being both true, and I don't want to use the word authentic because I know that's a loaded word, but being true to your own identity, but being just relatable enough to your audience. You know what I mean? Where it's not too exotic so that like people are like, oh, that's like weird, but also not like super, super diluted where like your Filipino side's like, that's not even Pinoy anymore. Like, how have you navigated that?
At least for me, it's we really tried to stick to, you know, the what you'd expect. Like adobo was our first like rice bowl we put on our menu. Lumpia was another. I mean, we sticked to like the very like if you've been to a Filipino party, if you know a Filipino, you've most likely had this food. Like the very common, I guess, items. You know, people have asked for dinuguan to go on the menu. They've asked for balut, and I'm like, look. This is, like, where I'm from, at least, it's Caucasian dominant. Like, that is what it is. Yeah. You know your audience. Yeah. If I put pork blood on the menu, they're not even going to come try it. If I have a freaking, you know, you go to some Filipino places and they have, like, just the raw meat just casually hanging in the window. I'm like, that is not, that's going to freak people out. Like, we are not, you're not in the Philippines here. That's not how it works. So, definitely making sure that it's within a certain lane, at least for us and what we do, because we want people outside of the Filipino culture to try the food, to love the food, and then to embrace it the way we do. So definitely staying within lanes of it, not being too left or right initially. Now, I would love to put balut on the menu as like a special item, and just like I would love to add dinuguan and be like, come and try it. Yes, it is made with pork blood, but like you will probably like it. It's just mentally getting past that. But and then as far as like, you know, staying true to who we are, you know, my Filipino side and my non-Filipino side, I think that that just comes with having to have thick skin in any type of business or any type of work you put out and do. You have to have thick skin and know who you are at your core to continue pushing your passion and your message with authenticity behind it, not being perceived as fake or an imposter. And people will. You can't please everyone, but like you staying true to you definitely gets the message across a lot more.
It's the same. It, for me, it was, it's really presenting authentically who I am, because authentically who I am is representative of both. And so I just, I believed if I told my story, the Filipino people would respond in a way that they would have some kind of common experience, even if it's from a different perspective. And then my Caucasian side would learn about it as well, learn about my other side. Because for me, it was about really telling the story, because I have an inherent belief, and I'm learning that it's true by meeting you and other people, that there are Filipinos out there who have to assimilate into communities and cultures where they, they're just, it's non-existent until we have arrived somehow. So, so me really telling, this is how it went for me. This is how doing that process went for me, is the truth of so many other people who are out there. So it, it wasn't always about making sure that people, you know, that I was pandering to one side or another, if I can use that word right now. It was more about saying, this is a story that is out there that not a lot of people are telling. And here is what it is. And I hope if you're reading this, you understand that this is going on right now, not just in America, but across the world, because Filipinos are everywhere. And, but we're not always in places where there are community hubs for us to plug into.
I think that's one, that's why for me, this book's really important, because I think it's much harder to try to bridge that gap with food, because people have an idea of what a recipe should look like versus a story. They're like, I can't really question the abstractness. Whereas in the food, like if they see me make a sinigang without pork, mm-hmm. they'd be like, well, that's not right. Mm-hmm. But then once you tell the story of like, well, it's freaking illegal in Saudi Arabia. What do you want me to do?
Yeah. Is it really illegal?
It's pork, illegal.
Pork's illegal?
Illegal. It's against the religion. So like, I didn't...
You couldn't have it.
Side story. My mom raised us on turkey bacon. So I'm here thinking like, oh shit, this is bacon.
You came to America thinking... Turkey bacon.
So then I went to the Philippines for like a vacation and they fed me bacon. And I'm like, yo, the bacon out here is...
And then
they were like, what do you mean? It's just like, this is like...
This is the
cheapest bacon here. I'm like, there's something about it. And then my mom's like, oh, that's because it's made of pork. And I'm like, okay, so what will we be eating back in South? She's like, oh, it's turkey. Because, you know, we can't have pork. I'm like, wait, so you're telling me this is how bacon's supposed to be? She's like, I'm like, my own flesh and blood.
Deceiving.
I don't. What else are you lying to me? You know. But that's the thing. Is like the book gives me an opportunity to put that story into context, yes. because otherwise it's like they see the food and they're like, well,
that's not right. That's not Filipino. Yeah. That's, you know, not how we do it.
Yeah. So like mm-hmm. if you were listening to if you were in the San Fran episode, they would have said the same thing, where it's so much harder to try to explain that story mm-hmm. on food, especially mm-hmm. if you mm-hmm. don't have the opportunity to tell the story mm-hmm. when you're serving, because you're giving mm-hmm. them a plate. Like, well, how do you get that across, right?
Yeah.
So,
and I feel like all Filipino food, all dishes, they have such a story. Like, that's what makes our mm-hmm. cuisine mm-hmm. so different. It's a labor of love, one. Mm-hmm. And then two, it's just like, there is so much more than like, when people eat our food, they're like, oh, I miss my Lola, or oh, yeah. I miss my Nana, or yeah. oh, this brings me back. And I'm like, it's so much more than just taking a bite of food. It's like, truly like an experience that's like deep rooted in our hearts and our souls. And it's like how we identify.
Which is why I think it's a double-edged sword, right? Mm-hmm. Because when you say to someone, your recipe is wrong, it's not like in like French cuisine where there is a codified, like, here's how to make it, right? Here are the mother sauces. Yeah. If you question someone, you can reference this thing. But if you question someone's adobo, you're implying that their mom taught them wrong.
Right.
You know? So it's like it's a coded yo mama joke. Yeah. Like, you know what I mean? And I think that's why people get really uptight about it. Like, oh.
Yeah.
You know. So yesterday we learned that we all have the same issue in the food industry, that like, there are always Filipinos that will come up and they will just like tear you down. And it's like, mm-hmm. do you know what I'm trying to do here? Do you know how hard it is for people to even want to learn about Filipino food, for them want to try it, for them to not only embrace it, but then to, you know, we have Caucasians that'll be like, oh, our daughter loves your food, so for her 10th birthday, we're going to cater Filipino. For all these, like, that is, like, to get over that hump is so hard. And then to have your own people just come and take it back to you. It's very defeating. Yeah.
So this is where I think I want to get into like the tactics of how you do it, right? Because there's one piece that is just, first, cook good food. And this mm-hmm. is food aside, mm-hmm. first, tell a good story. Mm-hmm. Like, whether it's writing a book and it's get the basics of writing well mm-hmm. down. How do you, what have you done to try to get that message out across and be successful? And I want to start with you, Delaina, because mm-hmm. when I was reading I don't know if logistics is the right word, but mm-hmm. how you got your book across, the fact that you were able to sell internationally mm-hmm. from your home office uh-huh. within 3 months mm-hmm. and you researched like all the platforms, mm-hmm. like take us through your process for how you then got this to go to market.
Yeah. So I think before, I have to back up in order to answer it properly. So I had for a couple of years just been feeling this thing inside of me that I was supposed to write something, but mm-hmm. I almost failed my writing class in college. Like, I had to beg my professor to pass me. Like, I really almost got an F, and that was devastating because I was, you know, I tried to make my parents proud when I was in high school. I was like, you know, in the top of my class. And so to go to college and to almost fail anything would have been like, what? And just financially, I got to take that class again. So I started feeling this feeling that I was supposed to write something, and I wrestled with it, you know. Eventually I got to the place where I just believed I'm supposed to do this. And so I think if for me, I had a faith throughout the entire project, and even after I wrote it, that the right doors would open up in order for it to go international. So I think if I had been beating myself down on top of my circumstances, I don't think those doors would have opened the way they did.
I see.
So I had to, while I was doing this, I had to believe, even though I didn't really have reason to. So I wrote it my Mac was broken. I had two missing keys on it, like at my kitchen table.
Is that why like your book doesn't have the letter K in it? It's just like missing the letter K for switching the letters.
Is it
I'm
really?
I'm kidding.
I'm like, wait, no, I got a copy editor and she was good. So anyway, I researched the platforms and it was really like learning from scratch. Like I knew nothing about publishing. I didn't know how to get something from my computer even into a book with a cover, with pages. And then I learned about self-publishing. And then I researched all the different avenues for it. And I just found the one that I thought was a good fit for
when
me.
When you say avenues, what do you mean? Like different platforms?
Yeah, different. There's different ways you can self-publish. You can self-publish in a way that takes you to Amazon. You can self-publish in a way where you just have like a warehouse full of books that you've paid for that you sell out of the trunk of your car, or your friends sell them from their food trucks or their flower shops.
Which route
shops.
Did you go?
I went the route of CreateSpace, which launches it on Amazon.
Got you.
And I liked that route because it financially made sense. It's print on demand. So there's not a warehouse somewhere with all of my books. When somebody clicks buy now, a signal is sent from Amazon to the nearest printing house to that person who ordered it. They print it right there, and then that's how it gets there in 2 days.
Oh, it's on demand.
It's
yeah,
on
that's
demand.
Awesome.
And it's on demand around the world. So what happened is it launched, and then after a few weeks, it did so well, it was selling. I got all these notifications that I qualified to go to launch internationally, and that these other bookstores had picked it up online. And I've never spoken with Barnes & Noble.
See, that's crazy, because I was going to ask you how you created the sales channels, because for you to, what was it, South China?
Yeah.
Wanting to pick that up, I was like, how did you get in touch with them?
I didn't. They found it. They found it on their own. Something about it selling well on Amazon, they found it somehow.
Interesting.
Yeah. And so it just became like a train, and it just kept going. And, you know, you got to be ready to be on it, because if you're not, you can't make it stop.
So what do you attribute the initial success to? Because if there were like thousands of other Asian girls in the South, I could kind of get that, right?
Yeah.
But it's safe to assume it's not the case. Like, what do you think resonated with people that you were like, oh, this did well initially?
I'm so glad I have the opportunity to say this on your podcast. It's my hometown people in Tennessee. I went to the county fair, which is like the biggest thing that happens where I'm from, is the county fair. I set a booth up and my parents came out and I told everybody, I wasn't even finished writing it yet. And I said, I'm launching a book. I'm writing a book. I had the cover designed and everything by then, but the book wasn't completely finished.
Yeah.
And I got a lot of community buzz because I was that little Delana from small town Tennessee. Hey, nobody's written a book before where I'm from. They're like, we're going to have an author from our town.
Dude, small towns, man, they go hard They do not play games. And they tell their family members, they like force them to buy it. It's almost like Filipinos in that way, right?
Yeah.
The support, which is awesome. Yeah.
People started buying it for Christmas presents, and then they wanted me on the radio, then they wanted me on the TV stations.
It was just
it took off in a location, a small location, but I had a lot of sales from that one spot for really hard for like 6 weeks. It sold a lot. And so that's what drove it. So once I launched and it went on Amazon and it sold however many it sold, then it got recognized as taking off really quickly by Amazon, even though it was just by my little town in Tennessee.
I think there's a lesson in that, and it's one that I even learned a little late with like our pop-up dinners in New York, right? Because you're always taught to create inbound marketing to try to get new markets and whatnot, and you end up diluting your product so it has mass appeal, right?
Yeah.
And oftentimes there is nothing wrong with creating a product that you know is going to satisfy your home court.
Yeah.
And you know what I mean? Like, what is wrong if all of my pop-ups, it's the same people and you're not branching out? As long as you make your crew happy, you know what I mean? Like, this is your home court and they're always happy to support you. Like, why not, right?
That's it.
Right. Is it the same case with the food truck where when you did your initial, here we have a food truck, right? Like, there was the home team, or it was like a struggle to like get an initial.
Oh man, year one of the food truck, every other truck out there had a line and we'd be sticking our heads out the window looking left and right like, oh shit, okay. Like, and that's just how it goes in the food truck industry that I've been exposed to. Year one is just you hustle, you grind, you take really minimal, small events because you just need people to know you exist. And then if they try the food and talk about it, it's a bonus. So for us, we started in the city of Milwaukee. Hometown for us, about 20 minutes south in the burbs. But starting in a city, doing like a lot of lunches publicly, that's kind of what started to drive our success. And then it was word of mouth. I mean, that to me is... Yeah. So much greater and bigger than any social media post I can make. Yeah, I can go viral on the internet. That's all cool. But, like, that doesn't generate sales for me. It generates awareness, which hopefully will turn into sales. But it's when people eat with us and then they tell somebody or it's like, oh, you just moved here. You're Filipino, moved here from California. You got to check out Meat on the Street. That's where you're going to get all your home cooking from.
How do you cultivate word of the mouth? Word of mouth. Because that's gold, right?
Word of mouth is you better have a consistent product. That is what we hear all the time. So they're like... You not only do we love you guys, we love your story, we love that, you know, you're young, you defy the odds, you know, I went against my father's wishes even, but I proved him right in a sense, or proved him wrong, proved myself right, proved him wrong, whatever. But it's consistency. Like, that's what you want out of any restaurant, right? Mm-hmm. When I tell you to go check out this really cool restaurant in Milwaukee, you go there and you tell me it was terrible, it's inconsistent product. Now I look bad. Now I feel like shit. And now I'm like, well, what the hell? But if you're like, hey, go check out this place in Milwaukee. It's so good. And she goes and she's like, oh my God, it was amazing. I got to tell my friends. Like, it's consistency. You have to serve consistent product every single time.
Yeah.
And I think to take that idea further, that consistency is what cultivates connection. Mm-hmm. And the connection is what drives the word of mouth. Mm-hmm. That's what gives people the passion, the inspiration to talk about it, is because you somehow gave them something emotionally to cause them to need to talk about it, not just post something about it, but really take time whenever they're talking to somebody. You know, I'm taking a part of this conversation to talk about this food truck. I'm taking part of this conversation to talk about this book or to talk about this pop-up dinner. It's worth taking time to speak about, you know?
Yeah.
And I think the reason why, and this is me guessing because I work in like social media industry, right? I think the reason why word of mouth is often, it's just too hard, is because it's hard to measure.
Yeah, correct.
Right. It's easier to measure how many likes you have, how many followers. And that's so much easier to track. You could create data points, you could create a whole system infrastructure to like measure the ROI of this thing.
Data.
Right. But how do you measure a connection, right? Like if I come to your food truck and eat it and I really enjoy it and I tell someone about it, one, you would never know unless I told you. And two, you don't know what's the value of that conversation. Yeah.
You're listening to Hidden Apron Radio, produced by myself, Paolo Espanola, and Ricky Ho. Just two ordinary guys trying to break bread and break boundaries. Thoughts, musings, ever just wanted to rant at us? Do let us know at hiddenapron@gmail.com or at hidden_apron on both Twitter and Instagram. Back to the show.
Where were we before we were...
Before we had, you know what we needed to say? We need some libations.
Interrupted by this weird.
Yeah. What were we talking about? Oh, measuring word of mouth. So a big part about us and what we do is, especially like, it's a family business. And my mom usually cashiers because she just does not do wine expo cook shit at all. She's like actually annoying. You want to kick her off the truck. But what she's really good about is talking to people. Cheers.
Cheers.
So she'll have a bunch of customers and she's a proud mama, man. She loves to rave about us. She loves to tell people our story and all this stuff. And what it does is it creates a connection deeper than just like, oh, Meat on the Street has dope food. It's like, oh, they're like a family. And then you become a part of our family once we get to know you and stuff. And that really has helped drive the word of mouth because they feel a connection to us in some way, shape or form. And then when they come to the restaurant, they're like, hey, so-and-so told me to come here. Like we really do try. Like, I may see you twice a year just when you come in, but I really... Dude, I am like struggling over here with this.
How did that happen?
Here, can you grab me the speaker? I'll turn it off. I was jamming before you guys came in here.
Mad high tech.
Right?
It's awesome.
Okay, we're off now. It shouldn't make any more noise. That was just my little brother. But but when you come in, I make sure to like know your name. What do you do? Who are your kids? Like, how have we met? Like, what is our connection? And like... I try and friend people on Facebook and Instagram so that when I see you doing stuff, I'm like, dude, you're killing it. Way to go. Clapping for you over here. Because I don't have the time to, like, go to events a lot. Yeah. So, like, I really try and make sure that, like, You know, when this, like, this orthodontist of ours, he comes in and his daughter works at this hospital that we go to, and we've cultivated this, you know, relationship. Well, I just found out, like, when I went to engineering school, I did dance team. Well, the youngest daughter is now on dance team. So I'm like, oh, I can't wait to make that connection. So it really is about that for us. That's very important to us.
The problem then becomes, like, how do you... Or maybe it doesn't need to be, right? Because, like, so you mentioned last night you're expanding. And then how do you make sure that carries over,
so right? Our employees, so, like, my, like, number one employee, Kelsey, she's my best friend since sixth grade. She went to Jamaica and Virginia with me. She's been a part of my family. We used to go prom dress shopping together. That's so, funny. Like, we hire a team that becomes family. My cook, Nikki, we used to work at a steakhouse together. She refers to my dad as dad. Like, we really try. When you work, like... My favorite high schooler that we worked with, even both of them, they become a part of family. Our dads work together. That's how she started work. So really, it's connection. You have to keep those connections because like you need to invest in your team. Like Matt and I, we're like, look, I'd rather have you guys make decisions and be wrong than sit there and ask me 1,000 freaking questions about this. Like, just make a freaking decision, man, and we'll move on from there. You're not going to do anything that bad. So, like, we really try and empower them, but also, like, we really want them to feel a part of it because then they're proud. And they are like, oh, no, it's not our food truck, but, like, we want them to refer to it as we or our business because it is. Because we don't get to this point without, like, a big support system. So that's, like, how we really try to keep it like that. And I know my uncle kind of told me that. It's going to be hard for us to expand because it'll lose that touch. But I don't think so. I think as long as you invest in your team, your support system, your crew, they invest back into you. And it invests all into the business.
Yeah, and it's not necessary that it's impossible. It just means it's hard.
Right?
There's nothing...
You have to put thought into it. Yeah. And you can't... We don't hire just any random people. That is, like, a big part of where, like, I feel like our success would go down or just, like, what we're trying to do or, like... where we've gotten to. Like, I can't just hire anyone. Right. Not anyone is going to blend in.
But that's underrated because you'll see a lot of... conferences or tactics around marketing say, like, oh, you know, what's the latest technology you could use to, like, track people? Like, oh, let's use chatbots or something to massively scale an operation. You lose culture there, right? It's hard to do that. So I think taking that scale question for you, Delaina, because I'm pretty sure this is not going to be your only book, right? Like, I'm pretty sure you're going to keep going. Or even if you take the current book, how do you keep going beyond the initial... home court advantage?
I'm not really worried about it. You know, I think for me it's really just about being true to who I am, to what I feel like my calling is, and just believing that whatever path that leads me down, that's supposed to happen. And I know that a lot of people who are from Tennessee, who are the big supporters of the book, they have been requesting a follow-up book, you know? So I'm not sure that has going to necessarily run out, because I purposely wrote the first one and ended it in such a way that hopefully readers would want more.
That was really smart.
Thank you.
Yeah.
You know, so I sort of organically built that into my first effort so that some of that would be taken care of if I decided to write the next one. So I think it's just doing things like this and finding new people to plug into and new projects. And
dude, when I come home, I'm going to be like so inspired from connecting. I'm like, there are people out there that are like me. Yes, let's get it. Like,
and there are.
It's the, you talk a lot about it. You just don't say it specifically. It's the blind faith you have as an entrepreneur, as an artist, as an author, whatever your grind and hustle and passion is, you have to. I mean, I have no safety net. I don't see a paycheck. I thank God I have parents who, like, are very supportive of us financially. But it's that blind faith. It's that seeing into the future and being like, I can make it happen. I just got to get there. Yeah.
To add to blind faith, though, is the going back to what you said, is the consistency. Mm-hmm. Because I think I know a lot of people who have the faith, have the passion, and they create a really good first try and then fizzle out because the consistency is not there. Whether it's a meal or a book or a podcast, right? And I think... it's really important, and I love why you keep returning to being true to yourself, because it's often underrated to say, get your head right first. Because people will ask me, like, you have a podcast, like, what tools are you using, what mics are you using, what this. I'm like, I can tell you that, but that's not going to solve your issue, because if you can't consistently produce your content, even on days where you don't feel like doing it, or you don't come at it from, like, a deep well of, like, here's why I want to do it. Because then otherwise you're Yeah. You get whipped around, right? You go with the nearest next trend. Right now it is podcasting, but who knows if tomorrow it's not. Like, will I just suddenly switch? No, because I love being able to record conversations that I normally would have had anyway.
Right.
So I love that you bring the whole, like, blind faith.
Yeah.
But I'm going to add, like, that consistency when it's, like...
It's true.
Yeah. It's not... I mean, we all know. It's not easy. It's not easy to do that, to push the envelope. Especially, like, we're all so remote. We're all, like... You and me have the same issues where I'm like, man, I got like maybe 10 people that are like gonna like really know what I'm talking about here. Like, it's an education process. Yeah. It's hard, but like, you know, it's if you, how badly do you want it? You know?
Yeah.
Okay, and I just,
time check, we're at like the 40 minute mark. Mm-hmm. So there's one other thing that I wanted to or two actually that I wanted to ask about is the issue of value. And I think this might apply more so to the food because we were already having this conversation, but maybe this will also resonate with the book. Mm-hmm. Actually, I'll ask, how much is your book retailing for?
$14.95.
Is that average for that type of book?
Yes.
Okay. The food. So we were talking last night about how the fact that she charges $1 for turon.
Oh.
Which has chocolate, by the way.
Wow.
And she charges $7 for rice and adobo. Okay, for me, I'm like, that's unheard of. Like, you try to charge that somewhere else in New York, like, you'd be out of business because you're operating on a negative, right?
Yeah.
But you continue to get pushback. And so my question isn't so much how do you message around that, but more on the philosophical side, how do you balance this idea that I'm worth this much, but also be accessible to the people that are your community, right? Putting aside the bigger global issue that for some reason we as a society have been taught that food should be cheap when it shouldn't. Like, we're willing to spend thousands for clothes, but it's not so true, right? But how do you balance value and what you believe is this is how much my product is worth, whether it's the book or the thing, and accessibility?
I mean, a big part of it is knowing your target audience. I mean, you're global versus we're very local. So that's one thing that I will say. The next part is you got to crunch the numbers to figure it out. You have to crunch the numbers to really have a realistic idea of how to get there. And then just it is a struggle. I mean, we want to raise prices, but Matt and I are terrified if we raise them, it'll go downhill. We want to raise them because we want, you know, like, sustainable products, and we want to do local farmers and meat vendors, but that all jacks everything up. And we're talking $1 to $2 here, and I already hear pushback for 6 ounces of rice, 6 to 7 ounces of meat on $7.
But it's not necessarily about crunching the numbers, right? Because, for example, if I crunch my numbers now, and I say, okay, for a pop-up dinner, I can charge $50 and just make it, right? I can do that, and so it's accessible to all. But I have a market that's telling me, dude, we'd gladly pay you double. Now, I could go double, and I could satisfy this market, but that shuts out the initial people who, I'm pretty sure they can afford it, but it's still...
They won't spend it.
Right, they won't spend it. And so that's what I mean, is like, how do you balance that, where it's no longer a question of profitability, because we understand that, right? You just got to break even first. But now it becomes an issue of value, of like, how much do you really value your product? How would you respond to that?
I would just, you know, I don't even know how to answer that question, just because, like, it's so hard. It's so hard to go up to someone and say, buy this from me because I'm worth it within a 30-second, like, interaction, right? Because that's what it comes down to on the food truck. It's, you know, it's buy my food, and then my mom's going to take your order, take your money, and then I'm going to hand it out, and I'm going to call your name, like, you know, whatever. Maggie, here's your food, and then that's it. And I expect you to invest in us on that level.
Well, let's take it hypothetically, right? Because we were having dinner last night, and we found out what exactly it took to go into food. I'd be like, dude, I'd gladly pay these prices, if not higher.
Yeah.
If tomorrow you found that there was actually a market for your food, that they were willing to pay 10 to 15 for a bowl, and you were willing to meet them and say, we're going to put like extra ingredients or whatever, but you know it would shut out a large part of the... I wouldn't say your home team pay, but I feel like the community that we are supposed to be tied to, right?
What would you do? We'd keep it on the low end. To me, like, I want you to come eat with us. Like, maybe I have to serve quantity and have a larger margin of error for quality then by serving more people. But I'd rather have you come and eat it than make a profit. It's more important for me for you to come and experience it than it is for me to make money off of it. So I would keep it on the low end. You know, as far as value, like, I want to sit there and tell you, like, you know, having us in the Filipino community is valuable, and we are an asset, and I can scream and pound on my chest all I want, but, like, you have to decide that. I can't force you to feel that way. So I don't really try and shove it down people's throats. Like, I really try, and this probably comes from waitressing in a steakhouse. You know, there are tables where I'd freaking be to them 50 times in a night because that's what they wanted. That's what they needed. That's what had to be done in order to make them happy. And then there were other tables where I would just drop off food. I'd make a funny comment. I'd walk away, and that was good enough for them too. And they both saw me equal value, but, like, I had to put in different work. So I think it really is just case by case basis, you know, and just really trying to make people feel like they get one-on-one attention without shoving, you know, I hate when people, Filipinos, they want to shove their crap down my throat about stuff, and I hate that. So I really try to not stay away from that, and I think that adds value, is when you can define it yourself, like you, like a customer, like, you know why it's valuable, not why the owner, the person selling the product, tells you it's valuable.
Got you. Well, I've had issues on the producer side where, like, people are like, "What? You're undervaluing your own work." I'm like, yeah, kind of true, right? But so I make difference with books and valuations of books.
Yeah.
So I don't even know if the question applies. But is there something about that question that you're like, oh, yeah, no, I could.
It's a very different answer. Okay. It's all calculated up front. There was a formula for me. I had an idea of what size I wanted my book to be. But once I clicked on, I want the book this size, this many pages, it's going to be It all formulated out. It said at $14.95, this will be your profit. But if you move it to this size book, this will be your profit.
Okay, so it wasn't one where like there's the issue in food where you could take the exact same ingredients, right?
Yeah.
But if I market this as a French dish versus a Filipino, the exact same ingredients, the price changes.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like that. It's more formulaic on the website.
No, more formulated. Much more.
I just wish. But that's a separate conversation.
Yeah.
Last topic I want to talk about is I don't know if work, because someone threw out this term last night of, like, work-life balance. I don't think that's the right word. I think what I asked on the first episode to that crew was probably more relevant is, how do you stay sane? Because for you, like, I've seen your LinkedIn, like, is it accurate to say you've had experience in sales?
Yes.
Marketing?
Yes.
And what's your role now?
Yeah.
What would you say it's more like?
I work for the largest tech company in the world, and right now I advise Google and Stanford University.
What do you say? It's consulting or
sales? It's both. It's consulting and sales. There's a sales component to it, but without the consulting, the sales don't exist. So it's a combination.
So it's not pure quota commission basis?
No, not pure. No.
Okay.
No.
So even then, there's, like, the consulting aspect that takes time, that takes energy.
Yes.
How do you stay sane and still manage to do this?
I think for me, my day job is what I do, but this stuff, the writing, the cooking, the food, the connecting with the people, that's who I am.
Mm.
If I can figure out how to make a living doing who I am instead of doing what I do, that's an ideal life for anybody. That's a very charmed life, you know, even no matter what kind of a lifestyle you're living, if you can really make a living just being who you are, doing what you love. And what I do is what I like the tech stuff that I do. I like that component too, but it is a lot of work. There's a lot of hours in my day, and there's not always enough sleep, and there's not always enough, you know,
you time.
Yes, there's not a lot of you time. I've
hence the bubbly.
Hence the wine and the good
hence music. Hence why I'm never leaving my hotel room. I'm going to stay here for as many months as I can.
When you said you were jamming out, I was like, I know what all of that is. Just those are not just words. Uh-uh. Those are like, my brain needs a vacation from my life.
Yeah.
You know? So for me, it's, you know, it's just really knowing I've got these tasks to complete today, I've got these things to look forward to, and just making it happen.
Mm.
You just make it happen somehow.
Yeah.
Staying sane. So I don't have a 9-to-5 that writes me a check. I just do meet on the street. I am the last person to see a check. I get all the shit.
Yeah.
Like, people, my friends are always like, well, you're the boss. Just make your employees do it. I'm like, who the fuck wants to work for somebody who does shit like that? I don't.
Yeah.
I don't want to be that person, and I don't want to work for someone like that. So I don't do that crap either. Staying sane is just surrounding yourself with a good support system outside of work. So I have my girls that are just, You know, they give me crap about working all the time, but, you know, they're always there for me when I need them. That's huge. You know, my mom, you know, I'll be like, Mom, I just do not want to do life today. This is, like, exhausting. You know, she's always my cheerleader. It reminds me of where we started, how far we've come, and look at what you get to do. Putting it into perspective. So I get to wake up and I get to go do what I love every single day, every hour of the day. I may hate it some days. I may struggle for weeks on end, but, like, I really get to live out my passion at 29 on top of it. Like, I'm still young and I can do a million things. And, like, I really remind myself of that. My brother is a huge fitness buff, huge. And he's pushed me and my mom to do it. And staying sane for me means I get a sweat session in. It means I escape. It means I get out all those, like, bitchy, angry, pissed off emotions through working out. And it helps me mentally work better, work more, work more efficiently. I mean,
that's scientifically proven,
too, right? But people, like, laugh about it, and I'm like, and I did, too. I was like, yeah, whatever, you guys are all psychos in the gym. Yeah. And then I was like, I am one of them, and it's like, I'll have a terrible day, and I'll go get a workout at 5:30. I'm like, God, I should have just done this at 8 o'clock, and I would have been better. And, you know, so that is a part of it to me, and it's just, like I said yesterday, you have to remember where you started.
Yeah.
Like, Matt and I laugh about how we used to stick our head out the window, and we'd laugh. My mom would be knitting, and she's like, I can't even... My mom loves to knit. I have all, like, custom-made, like, gloves and hats and scarves, right?
Yes.
And she'll be like, I brought my knitting, but I didn't. I don't even know where it is. You guys were so busy. So we joke now. She's like, I miss the days when I could just sit and knit on my shift, and now I have to work. So, like, it's, like, stuff like that, but it's just, you know, you got to love what you do. I don't love it every day. I don't believe that you ever love something 110% all the time, but, like, I love it so much. Yeah. Like, it's just part of who I am.
I'm curious, what type of workouts is does your brother put you through?
I have a different trainer. So he will not train me.
Okay.
Because
we're still... Is it like HIIT training? Is it...
So we do plyometrics. We do time under tension. We do HIIT. I mean, I'll lift weights. So I'll do squats. I'll do your deadlifts. He's having me do push-ups. He'll have me do any and everything. And for me mentally, it's going to sound so stupid, but, like, lately I've been like, you have to train the quit out of you. You have to train the quit out of you. And then that rolls into business where I'm like, God, I, you know, need to run here, do this, answer this email, hit up this person. I have to do, you know, like 25 things in 3 hours, but it's like, you train that, like, I don't want to.
It's a mental training, too.
Yes, it is. Working out physically is good. Just, I work on my feet for 16 hours a day some days. Like, I lift shit. I, you know, whatever. But it's really the mental thing that pushes me to that point. Agreed. And then when I meet other people who do the same thing, it's just, like, it's so infectious.
Hmm. Were you going to add something?
Yeah, I was, actually. When you were just talking, I was just thinking about, you know, that blind faith again. Mm-hmm. Just you saying you're 29 and you're doing this, like, you are... You're making a path. Mm-hmm. You are, like, a forerunner in this, you know?
See, I don't, like, see myself like that. You but are. Like, but, like, people tell us that all the time. Like, you guys are doing it, man. And I'm like,
I slaved all day yesterday and the week before. But
but it is.
You are. Yeah. And I think, you know, when we hit those obstacles and we're like, oh, what are we going to do with this? Or, you know, why did this go offline? Or what happened here? Or when something goes wrong, I think I have to go back to... You know, there's not a road for what it is that I'm necessarily doing, and even what you're doing and what you're doing. We're making that road so that people who in the future come, you know, are second gens here, second generations here, and they decide to do something that promotes their culture, maybe they have it a little bit easier than we do. You know?
Oh, it's probably going to be just as hard. I would actually wish it's just as hard.
It'll be just as hard, but they'll have different resources.
But, no, right. It'll be a different challenge. It'll be a different type of hard.
Yeah, to do stuff.
It'll be a different type of hard. I think the thing that I would add, partly because, like, selfishly, it's my podcast, so I get to put my
opinion to it. Yes, you do. You do whatever you want.
One thing that's, like, I found really helpful is almost a shift of the perspective, right? So part of it is you stay sane if you just maintain, like, this whole gratitude thing, as woo-woo as it sounds. But the other piece is, like, viewing your day job as not a binary opposite to your hustle job. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, totally.
It's like, for example, so I was partly in consulting for a couple of years, too. And part of consulting is doing these discovery sessions where you would ask these questions. I'm like, instead of applying this to help this other company, Mm-hmm. Why don't I practice those skills on a podcast? And so people were like, dude, this is so random of you. Why are you doing a podcast? I'm like, well, this is actually, I'm doing it at work. I might as well do it here.
Yeah.
And we had to do like, we had to write reports. I'm like, well, if I'm practicing that there, I might as well write a blog. You know what I mean?
It's, well, it's like you have to keep your creativity side alive. You know?
That's, yeah. It's like, if I'm going to learn the bit, if we just strip off the veneer of whether it's food or whether it's tech to the baseline skill, if I'm practicing it here, then doing this for food should be a no-brainer, right? Like, if I'm now in an operations role, and there's clear parallels between running the operations in the kitchen for a pop-up and the operations at work. So I'm like, well, then that means there is no... It's almost like you did mental judo. There is no conflict.
No. Right? Yeah. Everything blends together. Right. It's just you have to open your brain up to realize that.
Yeah.
You know
what instead I mean? Of seeing it as like, oh, I put 2 hours at work. I don't have enough hours to do it
it's
for this.
It's being so like structured with your boxes. Like, here's this box and here's it. It's like, no, they all get jumbled together along the way at different points in time.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
I think that's a beautiful point.
I get to say my piece. Did I miss anything? Was there something I didn't ask that you wish I did?
No, I didn't have any. No, I'm not feeling like any.
I stopped y'all enough.
Your show. I'm doing good.
Okay, so we're gonna end. So I'm gonna leave this as a choice to you. If you feel like, because it's gonna be the same questions as last night. And here's the thing: if you feel like your answer has changed in the last 8 hours. You can change your answer. Okay. I'm going to ask it to Delaney. If you're like, you know, I'm going to change my answer from last night, you can.
Okay.
Cool? So, this section...
This was fun. Okay. This was a lot. Yeah.
This was fun. This is a section that, like, is in every episode. The questions are really quick.
Okay.
But you can answer them as quicker or as long as you want.
Okay.
Okay?
Sure.
Person who most influenced you in what you're doing today?
My mom.
Okay.
I said my dad.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Best tool you've purchased for your craft, whether that's writing or the tech job or whatever. Whatever you define as your craft, best tool you've purchased.
A cast iron skillet.
I love that answer.
There's so many people on the show who've said the cast
iron skillet. That's an amazing answer.
Yeah. And you know what? There's trends in these answers.
Uh-huh. I said the food truck.
Yeah.
You have the most expensive answer in all of the episodes.
Well,
it's a big purchase.
Yeah, it is. Once again, the truck itself was not a lot, but everything that is in it now, it's worth a little bit more.
Three food ingredients to describe you. And I'm glad that you're not answering.
I'm not.
I'll influenced their answers last night.
I'll tell you my answers once you say them. I'm not gonna. Mm-mm.
I will say patisse, buttermilk.
That's a southern thing, man. That is such a southern thing. Was not prepared for that for patisse. I was going down the patisse road.
It makes sense.
No, it totally makes sense. I was going down patisse and then we went left and I'm like, whoa, was not prepared.
That's how I felt when you first opened your mouth at the other level. I'm like, what the hell just happened?
That was awesome. Okay.
Okay.
It was good.
Buttermilk.
Oh gosh. What would be my next one? Say I want one from my Filipino side, one from my Caucasian side, and then I want one that goes both that I use. Black pepper, I guess, because it goes both, but it's kind of boring. But I'm going to say black pepper.
Did you know wars? People died for black pepper back in the day. It was so expensive that wars were fought, countries were founded. Black pepper was a huge thing. Like the whole spice trade and everything. And now it's just
still
like,
expensive.
Yeah, now it's just like, oh, it's
boring,
pepper. But back then, dude, it's a big deal.
No.
Entire armies have to fight over this stuff.
Black pepper.
Mm-hmm. It's such a common thing.
Like, the more you delve into food history, you'll find that there's these things that like we now think of, like, oh, that's okay. But like, for example, celery was a luxury thing.
Oh my God.
It was served as the rich people. You had a special vase for this thing, for celery. And I'm like, really?
Yeah.
I'm like, dude, slap some pepper. I said soy sauce, vinegar, and garlic. That was my
love idea. It.
So the minute she said that, the other two, I was like, oh, fuck, man. Just like...
It's my bad, I know.
Although their answer might have ended up being like that. I wonder what would have happened.
Yeah, if they had thought about it,
If you had to recommend a single resource, so it's a book, movie, song, podcast, whatever, for the common person to consume that you think, like, you know what, everyone should consume this and they'll be a better person, what would it be?
I'd say the Bible. I really would.
Okay.
I'd say the Bible.
Specific version of the Bible? I don't know all of them. Yeah.
And I have, you know, I don't have it all memorized, but it's, again, it's blind faith that somehow in that book there's the purest good that we have access to. Gotcha. So I think that go wrong no matter across the board.
I just made like a bunch of titas in the Philippines like smile.
Oh, yay!
I'm like, yes, praise the Lord, you know. Okay. If Jackie had contacted you and she said you're going to be the only author in this book, you get one page, one line. To distill the entire story of Delano thus far, what would the line read?
The entire story of Delano.
Thus far.
You
don't
even
know. You don't know what you're...
One line.
What? That's so hard!
I had one person say a whole paragraph nonstop with the right punctuation. So they pulled it off, but like...
Wow.
And some people have done one word. So for you... Whatever, however you long you
think. Okay, I think I would say she was born, she believed, and she did.
See, that's another t-shirt.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes you hear something, you're like, that should be a t-shirt. That's a t-shirt right there. Mm-hmm. Love it. Okay, last question. This is more logistical. If people wanted to continue following your story, where would it be? So this is your website, email, Twitter, Instagram. This is it.
Look for Asian Girl in the Southern World. Look for a part two. Eventually there will probably be one. I'm on Instagram, Delano Beneventi, Facebook, Delano Beneventi, Twitter. I come and go on that one.
Ditto.
Delano Beneventi. Ditto. That's it.
It's all one word, right?
Yeah.
No underscores, no nothing. Okay.
Nope, all one word.
Awesome. Well, cheers. Thank you for returning.
Thanks for having me again.
Thank you for...
You make me want to do a podcast in Milwaukee, man.
It's not that hard, to be honest. I'm telling you.
I just don't know if I want to add another little area on my plate to do something else, but like, I love podcast. I love just chatting with people and like getting to know their stories, what they're about, why did it start, what knowledge do you have that I don't know anything about?
Yeah, but part of it's like... You're right. I'm now thinking of your schedule. It's just work. It's like just every added minute is added, right?
Oh, yeah. And people are like, well, just do it. I'm like, you know what? Just to do anything, there's so many steps that you don't realize that take to get it to this presentation moment.
Like, for example, like this, I'm going down to like the millisecond of editing, like sound waves.
Besides that, like you even getting to this point, you got to figure out who your clients are. Now you got to research them and stalk the crap out of them so you're prepared, and then you have to have some type of idea.
But that's the thing, right? If you somehow connect it to who you are, like it doesn't seem...
I know.
It's like, oh, I would have done this anyway.
Yeah. Uh-huh,
I would have like invited someone that I want to talk to anyway.
Yeah.
I just put a mic now in front of it, right?
Yeah.
But
I like it. Okay.
Good.
Yeah. All right.
Yay. Cheers. Cheers.